A Fire in the Heart of Knowing, Season 1. A fantasy story in many parts by Nick Shepley. This novel is brought to you by Verse Online and is the product of many imaginations, including the most brilliant Imagineers Alex Wills, Matt Troy, and Kat Nova. We hope you enjoy this journey through the lands of Aestus and its many peoples. Santaris Sindus was dying. This much he knew. There wasn't a life behind him that he could feel sentimental enough about to grieve for, and he was fairly certain that nothing, no salvation or judgment, lay ahead. He could face the end dispassionately, knowing that it would come either from the shaking sickness that clung to his chest like a specter, or from the cold steel of one of his closest allies or underlings. In Mordekaiser, such a murder was considered a kindness, speeding an old man along to the end that he had long ago come to terms with. He had already sent his various children, sired with many women across the realm, far from Mordekaiser's own shores, not that this alone would guarantee their safety.
A rather novel aspect of the blood-soaked successions amongst the lesser nobles of these lands were the purges that accompanied them. Assassins liked to be sure that there were as few vengeful relatives as possible to settle scores later on. In Santaris's case, though, there was no precedent. He was the first Lord Steward to have wielded power, and his slow, drawn-out death presented the realm with several dangerous dilemmas. There was no agreed method for succession, and as far as he could discern in every other kingdom across Aestus, such matters and traditions had been decided in the aftermath of war. Santaris almost wished he could live to see the knight commanders of his realm that he loathed equally tear one another apart. He had been the Lord Steward of Mordekaiser for 44 years since the Queen herself vanished into the deepest recesses of the Fortress of Caris, the battlements of which he stood upon in waves of icy rain as he contemplated the end. His killers wouldn't be subtle, they never were, and it didn't need to be discreet, just quick. The killing, when it came, would be public, but at least it would be swift. In certain parts of Mordekaiser, the infliction of long, drawn-out suffering was close to being an art form. The jailers of Tharta would have found the idea of a swift death absurd when a drawn-out one was available, though even by Mordekaiser standards, the Thartans were monsters. Even in age and infirmity, Santaris was an impressively tall man. He had lost much of the brawn of his earlier years, and now his robes hung from his shoulders like well-stitched rags. His long, lifeless grey hair, darkened by rainwater, hung about his shoulders, and his lungs boiled with fluid with every inhaled breath. Santaris had first started to cough blood 2 summers ago, and his physician, Lycellus, had been in no doubt about the cause. He had predicted to the day when he thought Santaris would breathe his last. Santaris had listened to every word with stony-faced impassivity. Lycellus had quite the track record for these sorts of grisly forecasts, and Santaris had no reason to disbelieve him. It was, of course, almost impossible to keep a secret in a conspiratorial land such as Mordekaiser, and Santaris didn't even try. He knew that his days were numbered, and whether the end came quickly or not was largely immaterial. There was nothing left in this life to live for, so death in a way made its own bleak kind of sense. He had come to Mordekaiser in the way that so many did, as a violent fugitive in flight from the Arklands beyond the Greater Ark Sea. He had been a soldier in the service of the city of Dran, the Great Hammer of the East, and had killed his captain by stoving in his head with a rock after seemingly endless humiliations and hardships. Santaris had fled along with a handful of his fellow soldiers who could no longer take the brutality meted out by their masters. They all knew that there was but one place where they could survive beyond the reach of Dran or any of the other states of the Arklands that would have handed them back their lords in a heartbeat. The cruelty that they had been subjected to turned out to have been a valuable education, as Mordekaiser opened its arms wide to the brutalized who were willing to become the brutalizers. Santaris understood this implicitly and left behind at Mordekaan's borders the parts of himself that were capable of pity or remorse. There had been moments over the last 5 decades when his conscience fluttered its wings weakly, like a small bird that had somehow nested in his heart. On each and every occasion, he had chosen to silence what remained of his humanity and instead embraced the darkness that his new ruler, the queen herself, asked of him. In return, the blood spilled, the lives ripped asunder, the victims consigned to the shadows and lost in the vast mazes of Mordekaan's prisons brought him advancement in her eyes along with power, privilege, and above all security. He imagined that somewhere in the eastern Arklands there was a Draenian justiciar who still sought to put him in a noose, and he never lost sight of the dangers that the vengeful lords of the city of his birth posed. They, of course, came to know him in an entirely different context, as did the king and the earls of Gotharand, the protector of Ark, and even the great Delmarahi of Delmara himself. They knew him as the master of Mordekaan in the dread queen's absence, and they preferred dealing with him, much as one might prefer dealing with a mastiff than a wolf. Where she had gone and when she might return were questions he had ceased posing to himself years ago. Indeed, they were questions that many Mordekaani had stopped asking. It hadn't taken much for someone like Santaris in Mordekaan to be noticed. The agents of the queen were constantly on the lookout for that perfect combination of desperation and cruelty, with some semblance of intelligence preferably. It was in this latter category that Santaris stood out from the crowd. The criminal refuse from across Estis had desperation in plentiful supply, and there was hardly a surplus of human morality amongst them. That rare ability to perceive how events might unfold, and to navigate towards preferred outcomes, the insight to know what others wanted and what they feared, and the ability to tell a lie without blinking, set him apart from the rest. It was what led him to Caeris, the citadel capital of Mordekaan, and to his first audience with the queen, she who had ruled the lands of the northwest for 3 centuries from the heart of the Crag, the name that most Mordekaani used to describe center of the queen's power. She, whose name supposedly caused candles to flicker and mirrors to crack. She, who was serenaded by the howls of her prisoners. She, who so it was told fell from the stars during the great and terrible sundering some 340 years past. She, who was known to the ordinary folk of Mordekaan as the Cool. Santaris had no idea what she had said during his first audience with her. In fact, he had precious little memory of any encounter with the queen, only the knowledge that he had agreed to whatever she had asked of him. He had been ordered by her to lead her Knights of the Flail from the coastal garrison at Raghrim. Their purpose had not been to fight Mordekaan's enemies abroad. The armies of the Arklands were too strong and too likely to unite when it came to containing the Cool and her forces, and the grain yields in Mordekaan were too meager to support her army in the field. No, there had never been any such military adventurism abroad. Instead, the Knights of the Flail were principally used to seek out dissent within the vast sprawling and mountainous realm and crush it mercilessly. The Cool had smiled upon his thorough methods and was most pleased with this treatment of the villagers of the Parfell, that she made him a knight commander of her armies at the Crag. Upon hearing that, there was discontent and anger regarding the lack of action in dealing with some abomination that had crawled down from the mountains to prey on sheep. Santaris had hanged so many villagers that farming in the district had collapsed, leading to hunger across the east of the country. In the stomachs of thousands of her subjects, the price of dissent was felt. The Cool had tasked him, as he grew in stature, with other missions. She sent him secretly beyond Mordekaan's borders to find scraps of parchment in distant archives, to search crypts and tombs, to hunt through the mausoleum city of Dankare. She had searched ceaselessly for something, paying no attention to ruling whatsoever. The stewardship of her people was barely a secondary concern, and it was doubtful that they could even be described as hers. Unlike other relationships between rulers and ruled, there were no bonds of fealty, affection, or any sense that the queen protected those that fell under her rule. Santaris sometimes wondered if the Kul would have been happier seizing uninhabited lands. It had been many years since he had left Karis, and only occasionally had he ventured into the alehouses of the old town, Parthanis, at the slopes of the crag. He had sufficient encounters with the people of Mordekaan to know that their lives were defined by terror and fatalism. Unlike Arklanders, who were encouraged to dismiss witchings by their church as an heretical superstition, Mordekaani knew all too well that they were real. Older folk across the realm remembered with dread the time of the Kul, not so much because of the queen herself, but because of her four sisters, known as the Norns. Both she and her dreaded siblings had vanished for 4 decades, the stewardship of her realm entrusted to him. His reign, he smiled grimly, was purely accidental. He happened to be available to her in the final hours before she vanished into solitude. Once his rule came to an end, there would no doubt be blood spilled by the handful of criminals and killers that had found a home in Mordekaan, but had never even encountered the queen herself. He smiled through the pain that racked his cold, dying body, imagining the spineless non-entities who would replace him coming face to face with the queen whose memory they all professed to revere. What a delicious and bloody moment that would be. There was nothing she enjoyed more than torturing sycophants. In his few encounters with her, he had learned that civility was something to be avoided. He also learned that there were only so many audiences with the queen that the mind was capable of enduring. He calculated that the maximum that any human could withstand was probably 5. Santaris also knew that his thinking had never quite been the same after his audience with her. He had summoned the potential new lords of the realm to his table, whilst they were collectively known as the Night Commanders. To imagine any of them deserving such a title was to stretch credulity beyond breaking point. Mediocrities and fools who were skilled in survival and little else. This was Mordekaan's future, and one of these men would no doubt take his life. It had been fortunate for most of those whom the queen ruled over that she had spent most of her worldly existence as a recluse. The dark, cold, rain-soaked, and in wintertime snow, blocked valleys and mountain passes where isolated communities of Mordekaani folk lived were remote from the centers of power in Mordekaan. They produced men and women who peered out beyond their wooden palisade fences with suspicion and fear. A low, resentful, and suspicious folk for whom strangers were either threats to be feared or dupes to be exploited. Any memory of life in the hinterland of the Draenian Peninsula, where hospitality between Draenians at least was considered an absolute moral imperative, was hazy for Santaris at best. Having spent decades experiencing the rottenness of Mordekaan and contributing to it considerably with violence and cruelty, he felt he would probably have despised the Mordekaani more had he not become one of them. The ache emanating from his lungs and an unsteadiness on his feet indicated to Santaris that it was time for him to call upon Lykelis to administer more of the elixir that eased the pain in his body but thrust him into endless, restless sleep. There were those mad or desperate enough to make their way to Mordekaan voluntarily, and there were others, like Lykelis, who made up the ranks of the Ranarai, a lower Vanic word meaning the cursed. No Ranarai ever intended to arrive in Mordekaan or stay permanently. Some were kidnapped and sold as slaves, others were shipwrecked along the coast, others still were duped into crossing the border north of Dankar or west of Gotharand, or came in the misguided belief that they could free an imprisoned relative. Those that weren't mutilated by the Thartans beyond recognition and kept as blind or hobbled slaves in the great caverns beneath Mordekaan's fortresses, known as the Field of Chains, and were perceived to have some sort of value, were kept at the beck and call of their masters, knowing that to run was a death sentence. Lycellus, once a well-respected apothecarist from the city of Ark, understood well that he lived only as long as he served. Santaris had scoured Mordekaan to find someone, anyone, who could alleviate his pain, and had discovered Lycellus in the darkest pits of Ragrim, somehow still in one piece, and had set him a simple challenge: make the pain vanish, even for an hour, or lose a hand. Lycellus asked to search the darkened birch groves to the west of Caris for fungi, and came back with a small pouch dripping with a viscous black fluid. Santaris had no interest in knowing precisely what he had harvested, only that it worked. Fortunately, it did, and the Archite was made Santaris's chief physician, and given luxuries that months earlier he could scarcely have dreamt of: a bed, warmth, food, and clean clothes. As Santaris hobbled back down the stairs, he called out for Lycellus, knowing that even if he was out of earshot, word would rapidly travel to him through the tribe of servants that spent their days at Caris trying to remain warm and fed, whilst avoiding anything that resembled work. A servant girl came to his side as he slumped halfway down a curving spiral stairway, but he impatiently waved her away. Unsolicited aid from others was something he detested. He staggered to his chambers, and moments later the physician arrived, ever anxious to please, ever aware of the consequences of failure. Santaris also knew Lycellus's deepest fear, that once his patron had passed away, the wolves would devour those that Santaris had protected. He sensed it in the brittle smile the man wore when he was summoned, and in the way his hand shook when he recorded Santaris's symptoms in his small booklet, knowing full well what they meant for both their futures. He was young, still, about 30, Santaris guessed. That was a difficult age for a man without a future, because there was still a flicker of hope alive within him, that he might flee, he might prosper, and even start his life anew. It was dreams such as these that would see Lycellus dead if he couldn't finally rid himself of them. Hope in Mordekaan was lethal. This brutal fact was one of the Kul's enduring legacies. Lycellus produced from the leather satchel slung around his waist a small glass dropper bottle with more of the viscous, bitter-tasting black liquid in it. He administered two drops to Santaris's lips and retired silently from his chamber with a quiet and obedient nod. In moments, the Lord High Steward of Mordekaan would drift into a dark, restless sleep, but at the very least, the pain in his chest would abate. Perhaps it was his fever, or perhaps the pain-quelling medication that Lycellus had given him, but for the next few hours, Santaris was gripped by the most powerful, vivid dreams. He saw the cold sun above him, felt the breeze across his body, and knew that he was somewhere else, soaring over the cursed lands he had ruled for so long. Santaris dreamed vividly of Mordekaan from the perspective of a hawk soaring high above Caris. He looked down upon the crag and upon the black fortress at its summit, and watched with a voyeuristic fascination as the various knight commanders arrived at Caris from across Mordekaan to discuss Santaris's impending death. In his dream, he could eavesdrop on their conversations, and was amused to hear the petty, paranoid delusions and fantasies that each man entertained. Some believed that Santaris had cultivated favour with their long-departed queen and had summoned them to Caris merely to humiliate them. Others were convinced that he was sicker than Lycellus let on, and others believed that he would linger for years. One or two dared entertain the possibility that Santaris had summoned them to Caris not to inform them that he was dying, but that the queen was returning. Mordekaan had endured a relatively stable 4 decades without her, but there were few that were convinced that the era of peace and order that Santaris had presided over could last. As the hawk drifted over Caris, Santaris saw Lycellus leave his tower and meet with each knight commander in turn, begging them to seek mercy from them when Santaris breathed his last. Santaris, even in his dreaming hawk state, laughed cynically, imagining Lycellus in tears, prostrating himself at their feet, but he also knew that none of the knight commanders would lift a finger to protect him. Deep within him, Lycellus had always known that the salvation he found in Santaris was only a temporary reprieve. Every day of relative freedom from Tharta was a heady mix of wild elation at still being alive and in the privileged position of eating enough to prevent slow emaciation, and the stomach-rending terror of being returned to its dark pits at any moment. He knew that he had to displease Santaris but once, and he would be thrown in a cell at Caris for days, only to be then dragged back to the Thartans to endure unimaginable torment. As the servants of the now-departed four Norns, the hooded blind sisters that served the Queen so faithfully, the torturers of Tharta were forbade to ride beyond the edge of their mountain domain unless invited to claim a victim specifically selected by the Lord Steward. They were forbade to enter the crag itself. Instead, they would wait ominously at the foot of the great black stone outcrop the Kul's great fortress was built on. They would sit on horseback and watch their hapless victim stagger towards them after being flung out of the castle. And in that waiting and watching, the torture itself began. Their prisoner, now handed over to them from the castle yeomanry, would have long come to the realization that even with a mile or so distance and a head start, any escape attempt was futile. The barren and inhospitable terrain of southern Mordekaan was the Thartans' ideal hunting ground. Lycellus dreamt the same dream, night after night, of being thrust through one of the many lower gates of the crag and stumbling across the barren earth towards the awaiting Thartans, who inserted steel hooks through his wrists and dragged him screaming across the mountains to the cell at Tharta he had been released from. As he howled in pain and terror, he begged to Santaris, to the Thartans, to the Keeper himself, for clemency. Every dawn he woke, pale and almost feverish, the feeling of an anvil's weight on his chest. Only the endless business of an apothecarist in a castle full of the malnourished and sickly distracted him from the memory of these dreams and the endless mortal thoughts that plagued him. He liked to think that the mere act of applying unguents and dockworts to boils, fevers and palsies made him indispensable, though secretly he feared that there was no such thing in this wretched land. It hadn't taken him long to understand the politics of life at the strange revenant court of Santaris, and what that implied about his future well-being. Survival at Karis was the product of patronage and nothing more. In order to preserve his own position, Santaris had ensured that he could only be succeeded by knight commanders from the provinces of Mordekaan, not through anyone in the Lord High Steward's personal court. The reasoning was simple. No knight commander possessed the forces necessary to lay siege to the crag and take it or Santaris's power from him, so a threat could never really come from outside. However, should a threat emerge from within, from a usurper on the Lord High Steward's council, then the backstabber in question would face a huge problem once there had placed the knife between Santaris's shoulder blades. Each of the knight commanders would rightly assume that their chance to succeed Santaris had been lost, and they would do the one thing that the rulers of the crag feared more than anything else. They would momentarily stop feuding between themselves and ally against whoever the new ruler in Karis turned out to be. This in turn would make the realm practically ungovernable, and shortly afterwards, balance would restore itself as the usurper took a fall from the castle walls and a new Lord High Steward was chosen from one of the knight commanders. Lycellus had been wise enough to avoid the small coterie of sadists who served Santaris. Ascamon, the master of horse and hound, who saddled Santaris mounts and set hunting dogs on his enemies. Paralind, the keeper of the realm's coffers, a man who used gold as a weapon, starving entire regions with grain requisitions when taxes went unpaid during times of hunger. Lady Rin, the Lord High Steward's watcher, a spy but a spy whose target was the ordinary people of the realm, ever searching for signs of dissent or discontent. Finally, Elder Gule, the keeper of his lordship's guests, the master of the prisons in the crag, and also the commander of the first watch, the crag's soldiers who were first to the walls if the castle was attacked. Elder Gula had no dominion over the Thartans and feared and reviled them as much as Lycellus did. It was rumoured that the torturers of Tharta had once removed Gule's left eye. Lycellus knew that his only salvation came from escape. If he was foolish enough to wait for Santaris to die, the Lord High Steward's replacement would decide the apothecarist's fate. He knew that the next steward would have to keep a handful of Santaris' inner circle. As it was never wise to dismiss everyone immediately and create immediate enemies where only future ones might exist. He held out no hope that he would be one of the elect, and he knew that there was only one place for him to be sent to. If he waited, he would experience months of torment before death, or before pleading to drink the oil of the grey root, the poison that rotted the mind and robbed any human of the last vestiges of what made them a person. It was how the Thartans became the creatures that they were. For once, all of them had been men. In some distant, deeply suppressed part of his thinking, he clung on to the notion that an apothecarist from Ark in his middling years, who once as a boy watched ships dock at Storm Row from across the vast expanses of the greater Ark Sea, should not be contemplating his own hideous death at the hands of grey-skinned, dead-eyed former men who understood nothing but suffering and pain. The reality he now inhabited was far removed from anything he had ever known or understood. He had once lived in dread of the thieves and brigands that robbed unwary drunkards in the side streets leading from Ark's great harbour. He could say with some degree of confidence that until he had encountered the Thartans, he had no idea whatsoever about terror and what it truly meant. The strange and terrible truth of the matter was that other than gnawing hunger, cold and fear, he had not been maimed by the Thartans, not physically anyway. He would never forget the screams and the howls of those he shared his imprisonment with, begging and pleading in all the voices that the Keeper had blessed his children with. He knew that should he fall back into the Thartans' control, they would flay the skin from his flesh, one strip at a time for years on end. Their greatest evil wasn't their ability to kill. It was their power to keep those in torment alive, allowing their agonies to be ceaseless. He would run before Santaris died, when there was enough moonlight to make it to the Crowland, a wilderness of briar and thorn which would tear at the skin, but would in no way compare to the flails of the Thartans. He would make his way south to the Nurundin River, and from there, hopefully escape to the coast, where he might walk to the city of Dancare and freedom. All of this, he knew, was highly unlikely, and as an insurance against the horrors of Tharta, he had used his considerable knowledge of plant and herb to create a small vial of disseminy poison, just enough to kill a man surrounded by enemies who desired his endless suffering.
Thank you for journeying with us through the shadows of Mordekaiser in A Fire in the Heart of Knowing. Join us to uncover the mysteries that lie ahead. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing the series. Your support is what keeps us writing, recording, and dreaming up a whole world. For more adventures and the lore behind the saga, visit enterthearkverse.com. Share your thoughts and theories with us on Twitter at VerseHome, or send a raven to verseonlinerpg@gmail.com until our paths cross again in the heart of knowing. Keep the fire of curiosity alive. Farewell for now.